Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for invitation to the KITP program on quantum control. And thanks also for many interesting interactions I have had here the last 3 weeks. And as you said, it's a sad moment that we are leaving, but I'll try to cheer you up with 2-qubit gates, perfect entanglers, and some aspects which are related to quantum control. And the reason, or the basic motivation why I'm focusing on 2-qubit gates is that 2-qubit gates are responsible for creating an entanglement between quantum systems. And of course, entanglement is a fundamental resource for quantum computation, quantum information processing, quantum technologies in general. So we can soon expect politicians, as Tommaso told me, we can soon expect politicians to talk about entanglement a little bit more.
What is he wearing? Grass.
This?
Yeah.
I think this is the St. Patrick's Day a couple of weeks ago. I don't know what this is actually. I think it's a little, it probably is a young shamrock, maybe from some pot they were sharing, you know, I don't want to go into detail.
Is the word is coming?
No.
Okay, it's being postponed.
Yes.
Yeah. So what I'm going to talk about are essentially three blocks of works. One which is related to foundations of the theory of 2-qubit gates, particularly so-called geometric theory of 2-qubit gates, which we worked out back in 2003, 2004, when I was a postdoc in Birgit Haveli's group. And this was a joint work with Jun Zhang from the Electrical Engineering Department. The second part will be about optimal control applications, and particularly about work which is now in progress, and part of the work has been completed, part of the work is in progress. That part which was completed is the joint collaboration with Tommaso Calarco, with Christiana Koch, Birgit Haveli, and we will see how this theory can apply in the context of optimal control applications. The last part will be about 2-qubit gates, not as a group necessarily, it will be there, but we will look at them more as a metric space, and we will try to understand how large are control targets, what is the real true size of control targets for optimal control applications, and eventually what is the volume of the space of perfect entanglers. So let me go to the first part. As I said, this goes back to history about 10 years ago when we worked with Jun Zhang and Birgitta and Shankar Sastry at development and first applications of the geometric theory. I won't go through all the applications, but would like to lay down the foundations. And of course, starting from the absolute essentials, 2-qubit gates are nothing else than unitary operations acting on the states of 2 quantum bits. So it's a map of the really rotation of the Hilbert space, four-dimensional Hilbert space to itself. And it can often be represented, of course, by, or it is represented by 4x4 unitary matrices very conveniently, which can be broken down into global phase times the SU4, which SU4 stands for the group of 4x4 matrices with unit determinants, so ignoring the global phase, which often is irrelevant in quantum mechanics. In the standard computational basis, I put down a few examples. This is the identity element of SU4. It's a unit matrix. This is another element of SU4. It's a direct product, a tensor product of 2 Hadamard rotations. So it's a 2 single qubit operations. It's really an element of SU2 cross SU2, which is a subgroup of SU4. Then we have these three gates, C0, C phase, and some unidentified Q gate, which we will see a little bit later. It's really a mapping into the Bell basis. But what is important here is that all these three gates have the same non-local content. They look completely different, but they can actually create the same amount of entanglement. Here are a few other examples, a little bit more exotic double synod gate, B gate, which we have found with the June back in 2003, 2004, square root of swap gate, which is known from solid state implementations, and swap gate, which is non-local gate, but not entangling.
Can I ask you something? So when you say they make the same amount of entanglement, I can construct SU4 mod U2 cross U2, the coset.
Yeah, we will get
to that. So are you just saying they're in the same coset, that same coset?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I can't hear you.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. They are equivalent up to the local transformations. But that's a big part of the first section of my talk. So.
But square root of swap is not, isn't it?
No.
Pardon?
But square root of swap is not in the same.
No.
No, it's just the middle.
No, just middle the row. Middle row.
Okay.
These three guys. Okay. So, of course, when we talk about SU4 group, we can talk about SU4 algebra, which generates the group through exponentiation. So that's rather well known. Here we have generators of the SU4 algebra, which are nothing else than products of Pauli matrices or identities. This is an example of the local gate. This would be sigma x acting on the first qubit while identity is working on the second qubit. And here what we see is the structure of the algebra. We see the Lie product or commutation relation, if you want, between these generators. And what you see here, obviously, is the local operations. These are generators which generate non-local transformations, so the real two-qubit non-local operations which can create entanglement. And these are the results of their commutation relations. And if you look really carefully, what you see is that they have this interesting structure, that the K forms a, there is a, you can break SU4 algebra into two parts, K and P. K is generated by the local operations, the single qubit transformations, and P are two qubit transformations. And you see that they satisfy the following commutation relations, as also indicated in this table. So this is a genuine subgroup of SU4. It's a subgroup of local transformations. It's a subgroup, it's a subalgebra in this case, SU2 cross SU2, and will lead to the subgroup SU2 cross SU2. What is interesting in the non-local part, that we can single out three elements of this space, of this algebra, and the TXX, TYY, and TZZ, which commute with each other, and they generate so-called Cartan subalgebra, or also Maxima Abelian subalgebra of SU4. And this is, there are just, generators are essentially up to I over 2, a product of Pauli matrices of the same type on the first and second qubit. By product, I mean tensor product in this case. Now, what we also see is that we have 15 generators, and that seems to suggest that we have 15-dimensional problem. And of course, we do, because it's SU4, so we have 4 to the square minus 1 different parameters to describe the entirety of SU4 group. But a good thing is, from SU4 algebra, the good thing is that we can carry out a Cartan decomposition of the group SU4, and that means we take any element of SU4, we can break that element, the consequence of the Cartan decomposition of SU4 algebra. We can break this element U into product or composition of three operators, K1 and K2, which are the local operations, and A, which is the non-local part, generated by these elements of the Maxima Abelian subalgebra we have seen on the previous slide. So now we have the structure down. So every single unitary operator from SU4 can be broken into such product in principle. Of course, we can do some parameter counting here. We need three parameters to describe a single SU2. Here we have two SU2s, so we have six parameters. We have three parameters for A and six parameters for this. So we have complete description of the SU4 embodied in this formula, which will pop out a little bit later. Obviously, we have two distinct operations, U1 and U2, which are equivalent up to the local transformations, then it's likely that there will be something in the central part which tells us that these two may be equivalent. In fact, the statement, the correct statement is to say that two gates which are locally equivalent, two gates which have the non-local factor, which have the Cartan decomposition with the same non-local factor, are indeed locally equivalent. Now, in fact, what we want is also the converse of the statement. So we want to know if we get two arbitrary gates, and they may even differ in the central part, do they actually have the same non-local content or not? Okay, so how can I somehow classify the non-local content of the operations? Cartan decomposition suggests that I can do it based on this formula, but if you look at it carefully, you see that even mere permutation of C1, C2, and C3 would give me the same result in terms of non-local operations. That will give me a different A gate in this little circuit, but would give me also the same non-local content. So obviously, there is lots of symmetry in the Cartan decomposition which may be removed. So now the question is, can I find somehow quantitative characterization of the non-local content of the elements of SU4 group, which is unique? That means, let's say I would have three numbers, as suggested by our parameters. If I have two distinct gates, these numbers, and I calculate these numbers for each of these gates, I get the same values for these numbers. I want to be sure that this means I have the gates of the same non-local content. And for that, I need local invariants. To construct these local invariants, we can follow the procedure developed by Yuri Maklin and elaborated further by our first work on the topic, where we start with the Cartan decomposition of the SU4 group in the following form. Then in the second step, we transform this into the magic basis. So this is the magic basis. This is the corresponding transformation. You have seen it as a Q gate in a few of those examples which I gave earlier. And then by transforming U into the new basis, we get a unitary operation UB. Now in the magic basis, if we break it down into these factors, they transform into a new operators O1, F, and O2, new matrices, such that O1 and O2 are now elements of SO4 with this very convenient property. And F becomes diagonal. That's the central part which comes from the non-local operations. So this will become a diagonal operator. In the next step, we get rid of the first local part, O1, by constructing the Maklin matrix. Taking UB transpose times UB leads to the elimination of O1 transpose times O1, which is identity. F is a symmetric, it's diagonal, so we get F square, and the rest is just a transformation by the O2 gate, which comes from the second local part in the Cartan decomposition. Now, interestingly enough, we calculate what are the eigenvalues, we get a characteristic equation. The characteristic equation depends on the trace of M and trace M square, suggesting, of course, that the eigenvalues will depend on these quantities as well. This is extremely convenient because of the cyclic permutation of the trace. It gives us an opportunity to eliminate further the local part O2 by taking simply a trace of the Maklin matrix. In this case, we got rid of all the local gates. We are left with a pure non-local content of these operations and taking some functions of the trace of M and trace of M square, we can define three local invariants which are providing unique description of the unitary operations from the point of view of their non-local content. So now having the local invariants, of course, we can split the entirety of SU4 into the different local equivalence classes. That means classes, sets of unitary operations which are equivalent up to the local transformations. We can also relate these G1, G2, and G3 thanks to the fact that the spectrum of F square depends on C1, C2, and C3. We can relate G1, G2, and G3, the local invariants into the Cartan decomposition directly. That will turn out to be extremely helpful because if we just look at the non-local part as it comes from the non-local factor as it comes from the Cartan decomposition, we see that we have three parameters here, C1, C2, C3. These are real numbers. In fact, because of this is a complex exponential functions and these are commuting observables, we get product of three periodic functions. We can see this as a three torus. We can plot it can plot these values as the points in the cube with periodic boundary conditions. And then looking at the local invariants, we can identify that these local invariants remain unchanged if we take into account interchanges of C1, C2, and C3 with and without sign flips, which further helps us to reduce the symmetry already intuitively felt at the beginning, to reduce this symmetry further into something which would provide more unique description of local equivalence classes and which is called wild chamber. Okay, so these interchanges with and without sign flips lead to slicing the cube by planes which are perpendicular to each of the face and diagonal, and we get eventually the wild chamber. Now, the point is that inside of the wild chamber...
May I ask you a question?
Yes, of course.
So where is the Cartan decomposition goes to the three torus? I'm kind of... I'm not good here, so...
Sorry, I don't understand the
question. Why is the Cartan... On the previous slide, you said the Cartan decomposition can be mapped to the three torus.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Why is that?
From this expression.
I don't consider that special. No. I'm just saying that's the fact. You know, you have three periodic functions of three operators which commute. So you can break that into three exponential functions. You know, three periodic functions really, and then each is characterized by one parameter.
So this is three torus.
So it's like a three torus. Or if you want, these parameters go from 0 to pi with periodic boundary conditions. That would be the same thing. You know, once you get to pi, you are back at the identity. Okay? That turns out to be rather somehow relevant. Let me just continue. Okay, so here, inside of the wild chamber, every single point corresponds to one local equivalence class. And here are the examples of these local equivalence classes. This is the identity. So if you run the dynamics, this is where your dynamics starts, okay? Dynamics under some 2-qubit Hamiltonian, of course. And then it evolves into the wild chamber, okay? This is the C-naught operations, which you would reach by simply evolving along the easing type of Hamiltonian. You could get to square root of swap gate by evolving under the Heisenberg type of Hamiltonian, for instance, okay? You can also get more exotic gates, like B-gate, which we found with Junzhang. You can have double C-naught gate, it's located here. It's the whole local equivalence class, it's not a single gate, okay? You have a swap gate, which I said is non-local, but it's not entangling gate, that's the only exception. Identity and square root of swap gate, swap gate itself are not entangling operations inside of the wild chamber. The rest, uniquely, every single point inside of this chamber corresponds to single local equivalence class. So the control problem which you may envision at this point would lead to simply the same picture as flying an airplane inside of a three-dimensional space.
So what do you said every point inside the chamber is what?
Is a corresponds to a single local equivalence class.
I'm just trying to put all this in a group theory. I'm thinking of the coset.
Yeah, that would be one coset. The whole SU2 cross SU2 orbit would collapse into a single point.
That's a tetrahedron? Tetrahedron?
Yeah.
Okay, so the chamber's a tetrahedron. Every point in the tetrahedron corresponds to unique...
Uniquely, to a single local equivalence class, to the whole coset, if you want.
Okay, so to a single representative of a coset. SU4/U2.
No, to the whole class.
Whole class.
To the whole class. Every single point is the whole class. This point corresponds to C0 and everything that you can get out of C0 by applying all the local operations before and after the gate.
Yeah, that's okay. That's what I thought I was saying. Okay.
That's what it is. Yeah. Okay? Now, perhaps interesting question could be, you know, something about perfect entanglers, because even though all these gates are non-local, with an exception of the class of identity and class of swap gate, you can ask, where are the perfect entanglers inside of this wild chamber? Turns out that perfect entanglers is defined as maximally as gates which are able to produce maximally entangled state out of some initial product state, are characterized also by the following property, that the convex hull of the Machlin matrix, the eigenvalues of the Machlin matrix, like this, contains zero. If it contains zero, then we can talk about perfect entanglers. Okay, that's the theorem which was outlined or stated actually by Machlin and proved by ourselves. So, for example, C0 gate has four distinct eigenvalues of the Machlin matrix, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, and then obviously the convex hull contains zero. So the C0 is indeed a perfect entangler. And any element of this class is again a perfect entangler. But also B gate is perfect entangler, in fact, very interesting perfect entangler. And so our double C0 is square root of swap gate. And everything what is inside of this polyhedron of perfect entanglers. So this is a slightly different representation. Now, laid back to back, I said that each point inside of the Weyl chamber corresponds to a single local equivalence class. That means to full set of, you know, unitaries equivalent up to some local transformation. But that's true with an exception of the base. The base is still periodic. So this is an identity. This would be identity again. Okay. So in fact, if you look at the set of local equivalence classes, not in this Weyl chamber representation, but in the representation given by the local invariants, this is the picture you would obtain. Meaning that the triangular face of the tetrahedron, if you say it like that, will in that new representation collapses like that. Okay, so these identities, which are repeated here, now form a single point over here. Now, all the dynamics starts again here. So if you run Hamiltonian, two-qubit Hamiltonian, you evolve into this field. You may also go straight to the C0 if you evolve along the Ising, with an Ising type of Hamiltonian. You can hit square root of swap gate. It's really a little bit behind, hidden behind this Eye of Sauron kind of model. This is a swap gate, exactly opposite towards the identity. Okay, and so on. The B gate is right in the center of this. This is now the set of perfect entanglers. It's right in the center of the set of perfect entanglers. And double C0 would be exactly opposite, would be the edge, would have similar edge on the other side. Really.
So the perfect entangles on the right side?
Pardon?
The perfect entangles.
Perfect entanglers are here as a part of the body of this. One of my postdocs suggested it's called Eye of Sauron. Mm-hmm. It's Eye of Sauron. Okay.
Sauron?
Sauron or
Lord of the Rings.
I think it's from Tolkien's story.
Lord of the Rings.
Oh. Yeah.
Sauron.
How is it pronounced correctly? Sauron or Sauron?
Doesn't matter.
He doesn't.
It's there, you know. It's looking at you. You know, perfect entanglers are watching you all the time. Okay, so let's go back to dynamics a little bit. This is a simple Hamiltonian and contains 2-qubit part. If you would have a Hamiltonian which contains only 2-qubit part, you would just evolve along the straight line in the Weyl chamber. Okay, from local equivalence, you change entanglement, you change non-local content of the operations, you evolve from class to class. So that gives you translation inside of the Weyl chamber. Single qubit operations will give you curvature. So that if you have Hamiltonian like that, that results in evolution which is curved inside of the Weyl chamber. This one is restricted to the base of the Weyl chamber. The objective we were following here back in 2003 was to hit the class of C0 gates. I would suggest that this is probably the first idea of control in context of the wild chamber, right? Because, you know, that's when we developed the geometric theory and put down the first application. By tuning the parameters, they're trying to find the target, which in this case was local equivalence class of the Sinan gates. But we want to do better than that, right? We want to explore this idea a little bit more. It's very fruitful because all this 15-dimensional space of two-qubit gates, which we, you know, described earlier, is now collapsing because we are interested in the non-local content. It's collapsing to a three-dimensional, flat, Euclidean type of picture. And it seems very powerful from the control point of view. Okay, it certainly connects with our intuition very naturally. But what we will be talking about are those further applications of this optimal control ideas in the context of geometric theory of two-qubit operations. And we will focus on a target. Okay, and what we will be doing is, in the first step, you know, if you go back to deep history, of course, there is an idea which stems from Ronny Koslov and Jose Palao and Christian Koch to optimize, to use optimal control theory to generate a specific unitary operation. Now, I'm suggesting, and I've suggested that some years ago at the previous KITP program, that we could abandon the whole picture. But this is a wrong picture. We don't want to go to a specific unitary operation. It's very restrictive. It's a very, very small target. Instead of that, we want to go to the full local equivalence class. We want to go into that full SU2 cross SU2 orbit, or even double orbit, okay? And that means instead of targeting some small epsilon neighborhood, or getting to some small epsilon neighborhood of a specific gate, we want to get to the small epsilon neighborhood of the whole orbit, which is now, you know, having two, in this Cartan decompositions, K1 and K2, has 12 parameters. We are getting, instead of a single point, we are trying to get to 12-dimensional manifold. Okay, and it's obviously much larger space than a single point. Okay, so that's the idea which you're trying to pursue here. And it was amazing because this idea came, we discussed it here at the last KITP program with Tommaso and with Christian and with Birgit, and it eventually materialized into this beautiful work. I should put another student here, Daniel Reich, who is here in the audience. And they did these fantastic calculations. They designed an optimization functional which takes into account these local invariants. The local invariants, you understand, are very easy to calculate. If I give you a unitary operation, what you do is you apply some change of the basis. You apply 2 4x4 matrices in take one and its bigger. And then you do some more multiplication of matrices. Very simple thing to do. And at the end of the day, you take traces and you are ending up with a local invariance, G1, G2, and G3. So from the complexity point of view, it's very easy to calculate the local invariance. Even if you do not have the Cartan decomposition, you do not need Cartan decomposition to calculate local invariance. That means for each moment of your control procedure, you can check this functional relatively easily. Now, you may argue that, you know, the space of local invariance is not particularly flat, right? So maybe this linear distance is not a good measure. And you would be right, if I would like to know how far I am from the target, then it would be a wrong measure, okay? But actually, it's a good measure if I'm close to the target. And that's the control objective I'm following.
So this is just for particular form of the Hamiltonian, right?
I'll show you some systems here involved. Okay, this is, so far we are talking very general. You know, these are local invariants. I'm trying to get to a design predefined local equivalence class, so I know the values of G1 and G2 and G3 of the target. Okay, in fact, I have just three numbers to describe the whole
is it now, how are we doing on time?
Whole orbit like this.
I got lost because I find it very interesting, obviously. But,
I think you are doing fine. Yeah.
We're doing fine.
Yeah, yeah. I'm doing fine. Good that you ask. So, okay. So we want to get from this picture onto this picture. But now this whole orbit is described by three numbers, G1, G2, and G3. Okay, and that's where we are trying to get to. And of course, during a propagation, I know the target values of G1, G2, G3. I want to get to the target. And during evolution, I can check the values of what unitary operation I will get and optimize the whole process, okay, to get as close as possible. And if I get close, this is indeed a manifold, so if I'm really close, then this linearized measure is a good measure of distance, okay? Now, I won't go through the implementation, but it has been implemented by Matthias and Daniel in this effective spin model with an extreme success. I'll show you only this B gate. Here you see this is the direct optimization. You want to have a B gate with certain Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian, okay. You run the dynamics, you want to optimize that, find the optimal field or parameters. You don't do really well here. In fact, you do really, really bad. Now, if you go for the local invariance, you improve by a few orders of magnitude immediately, okay, within very short time. Similarly, for the CNOT gate, here you see that if you once optimized it and you know what target you can reach, then you can pick that gate and put it back into a direct optimization and see that it kind of converges faster. That's because this metric in terms of this linearized metrics in G1, G2, G3 is not a good measure for a long distance. Become better in the short distance, okay? That's my hand-waving explanation, actually. The second system was Rydberg gate with trapped neutral atoms. And here again, you can see considerable improvement. And even Christian and Tommaso and Birgit put into it other processes like losses and spontaneous emission, which turn it into much more interesting things. But now when we optimize with respect to the local equivalence class, it's a great objective, we should pursue it. But we can also say what we really want in many quantum information and quantum technology applications is an entanglement, right? We want the politicians to, at the end of the day, to talk about entanglement, how much, you know, we can provide and so on. It's a fundamental resource. It will be as important as coal or gas or other things in future, no? So what we really want is to make another step forward in this direction. And instead of optimize with respect to the local equivalence class, to optimize with a full set of perfect entanglers. Okay, now this is exaggeration. This is very small now, okay, compared to this. This is huge, huge. I'll show you how huge it is shortly. And for that, we designed the following function in terms of G1, G2, and G3, which actually goes to zero once you hit the perfect entanglers. It's an optimization function which you can take, plug into your optimization function and run the optimization, as actually is happening and has happened very recently in Tommaso's group. I don't show you the result because I don't have time for that, but Tommaso has already run the experiments on transmons, I believe, and on NV centers, which actually show dramatic improvement in terms of optimization, okay, if you optimize with respect to perfect entanglers. We are optimizing, this is now our target, this red, this is half of this Eye of Sauron, okay, this is half of it, the other half is here, and this is the set of perfect entanglers, and this is the plane which cuts it into numbers which are positive above and negative underneath. So, now what can we do more, okay? Can we, it seems like we exhausted the topic, right, at this point, but we did not. we started to be more interested in real metric properties of this group SU4. So we started with some clever parametrization, simply writing this as a single qubit gate in this form. This is a single qubit gate on the first qubit. This is on the second qubit. This is the non-local part. Of course, if we put it together, we get a 15 parameters, as we would expect. You know, this is a local operation. These are two local operations on the first and second qubit, and this is second two, and this is non-local part. And then what we want to calculate is the real invariant volume. If we look at the Weyl chamber and look at the set of perfect entanglers, the set of perfect entanglers occupies exactly half of the volume of the Weyl chamber. Okay? But that does not seem to be quite the real volume. It's the volume inside of the local equivalence classes, and each class has attached this SU2 cross SU2 orbits. And they are curved, so we have to think about curved space. For that, we calculate invariant volume, so-called the Haar measure. We start with the Haar measure and then calculate the invariant volume. Okay, this is a brief description how to do it, and this is how it looks like for the SU2 gates. This is the Haar measure for SU2. So this is the invariant volume, which does not change if you carry out translation inside of the group. You can do it also for SU4. When I'm close to finish, you get something more complicated. You can also do it separately for a non-local part and, in fact, prove to yourself that this is indeed a flat space. Okay? You can also do it through calculation of a metric directly. And then you can ask, how large are our control targets? If I take a volume in the Weyl chamber, little cube of the size A, small A, what is the volume? And the volume, the largest volume, is right in the center, right in the around the B gate. Okay, if you take a small volume, the same cube of size A, around the B gate, the invariant volume is bigger because it's curved space with lots of density in it, okay, if you want to see it like that. This is the way to see it. If you cut it in three different horizontal layers, this is for C3 equals pi 12, so this vertical axis is C3. These are cuts through the horizontal layers at different heights. You see that close to the bottom, this is a huge improvement. A huge volume is concentrated in the center of the base, or close to the base of the Weyl chamber. And in fact, you can calculate the volume around different gates, and you find out that smallest volume, smallest invariant volume, is around identity and swap gate. It's on the order of 8^9 if you do a small a expansion. We have an explicit expression for these. Then the biggest is B gate. It goes as 8^3, so it's huge compared to, let's say, 8^9. These are A is a small number now. C naught and C phase, of course, are all sitting here, and they are going as 8^5, and DC naught goes as 8^5 as well. So C naught and DC naught are, from this point of view, somehow symmetrical, as well as swap and identity. But the biggest concentration of volume is really, invariant volume is really in the B gate. Now the question is, we calculate these volumes of little targets, different local equivalence classes, in the Weyl chamber. So what is the invariant volume of perfect entanglers? In other words, we know that it occupies half of the volume of the Weyl chamber, but how large is the volume of perfect entanglers in SU4, in the full SU4? So what is your guess, Ivan?
Professor Colony. I would imagine it's actually fairly large, a good fraction of the...
50%?
More.
Any other guesses?
Much less.
Much less? Very good.
25%.
Pardon?
25%.
25%. It's over 84%.
Wow. Yeah.
In fact, if you would regard control target as a perfect entanglers, being the control target, and if you try to clay shoot on such a target, okay, so, you know, clay shooting, this would be the clay. Okay, so it's really impossible not to hit it, in a way. Okay, now I suspect that there might be connection with the recent work of Tommaso, because if you just randomly pick, you know, optimization, you end up anywhere uniformly inside of the wild chamber. Probably, if you look carefully, 84% of that, you know, ends of the optimization, end gates, will be inside of the perfect entanglers. Okay? And that's about it. I could conclude, of course, and I appreciate collaborations which we had with me and Manut. It was a work of Paul Watts and Maurice O'Connor, our master's student, who did a project on these last topics we have seen. He looked at the size of control targets, and he will probably continue working with me for some time to go. The initial work goes back to Birgitta Whaley, Shankar Sastry, and Jun Zhang's collaboration at Berkeley, which of course continues in terms of Birgitta being involved in the follow-up projects on optimal control applications of these ideas with Christian Koch, Daniel Reich, Tommaso Coarco, Matthias Miller, and Heidong Yuan, which was published. There is a follow-up work on optimization with respect to the perfect entanglers, and I think it's about time for me to stop. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so I get the idea of having a target that's not a specific entangling gate, but rather a class of entangling gates.
Yeah.
So one of the things I work on a lot is quantum simulation, where I want to be able to, you know, simulate some unitary evolution, and then it's decomposed into a sequence of unitaries. In that case, where I'm not chasing entanglement, yeah, I need it, then I don't know if yours is, if this method is going to help.
It can help you in a way, because the first bulk of the works which we did with John was about construction of universal quantum circuits. So in a way, it depends what you want. If you want a specific gate, then it's a different story.
So it's what
if you go for a local equivalence class, then this will help you, because it's
I'm trying to get an idea of when this helps and when it doesn't. Okay, so you're in my way of translating it to a mathematical framework, you're saying instead of aiming for an element of SU4, aim for an element of a coset.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I'm trying to get a sense of whether it's going to, where it helps. So you put it in the context of entanglement. You're saying, well, if the goal is strictly to entangle, aim for that, and most cases they're perfect entanglers. Is that correct?
You know, it's the wild chamber that gives you the non-local content, and subset of the wild chamber are perfect entanglers. It depends what your target is. Like, if you want to follow the evolution,
I understand. Okay, so let me put it this
maybe
way.
Maybe a different thing, you know?
Yeah, no, but we're talking about the same thing. What I'm saying to you is that I'm trying to get a sense of where I would use your method and where I wouldn't. Okay, and you're saying it depends what you want to use it for. So I'm saying, can you give me a sense of where it's useful, where it's not? And you're saying, what do you want to do? That's kind of the dialogue we're having.
Yeah, because, you know, I think this is a little bit like a tip of an iceberg, which I know well, kind of very well, maybe. And you are asking, what is under the water? I'm not sure I know that, okay? Just because knowing the tip of the iceberg. So I think it's up to you to find out whether this matches your objectives. But what I'm trying to say is, here, this is a classification of the two-qubit gates in terms of their non-local content, in terms of the elements of the coset, if you want. And it uses certain particular direction, you know, or offers certain applications in optimal control theory, also allows to quantify things which are more foundational, like how many perfect entanglers we have. Okay? I don't know the objectives which you have, so I can't tell you.
Yeah, so if you have a Hamiltonian which can generate an ergodic flow in the wild chamber,
So we'll just for controllability. Basically, you say that when you make a random control, mm-hmm. you need three random controls, and you can be more than 99% sure that you hit the perfect entangle with that. So there's actually no real need for optimization.
I would not say so, because it very much depends on the Hamiltonian. If you have Hamiltonian, which is ergodic, which is not often the case, I believe, then...
Well, full controllability reaches sufficient, because if you have full controllability, of course, it must be ergodic, because otherwise...
You can also add the question, how quickly do I get to the perfect entanglers?
That's true. But I'm just saying that...
You don't want to kind of move around. I had this little example here, which I think is maybe useful in that context. Well, this is a specific evolution, which you can see did not quite go as you would like, let's say, to C not gate. Okay, obviously it's not ergodic. You can argue about that. How do you know it's ergodic? It's another question.
That's true, but what would you think? I mean, just intuitively, what, let's say, also random Hamiltonian, for instance, when you put this randomness, how much this can actually reach? In terms of perfect entanglers.
Yeah, I mean, very much depends on the Hamiltonian.
Seems, yeah, seems yeah. like a property of the system that gives you perfect entanglers for free, so to say. So the question is, when you don't have full controllability, how much you typically lose, when you, for instance, can only steer one direction in the wire channel?
Very much depends on the system. On the Hamiltonian you have at your disposal, on what objectives you want to follow, and this is very general, very abstract for me to address, you know, but it's definitely not that you can discard control because the perfect entanglers occupy 84% of the SU4, you know. You know, it's true that it's a little bit like shooting. This is clay target, right, which is big, but you still may not even reach that height.
I was just thinking from a control perspective.
You are saying if you do, then of course you hit it at the end of the day.
I would say that this very beautiful end of the world picture is very suited for concluding our discussion with the speaker, whom we thank again.